All right, my next guest tonight, good friend Henry Schulman joins the show. You guys all know who he is, former writer for The Chronicle. He's a current freelance writer, broadcaster, editor. One of my good friends joins the show. How you doing, Henry?
I'm doing just great. Thank you for asking.
Well, it's nice to catch up with you. Really appreciate you coming on the show. We might as well get right into it. The big news yesterday was Buster Posey's an owner of the Giants. Do you think that was a planned out thing? You think they just came up with it? Was it something maybe in his contract where at the end of your career, we're just going to put X amount of dollars into ownership group and you could be part owner? How do you think this whole thing evolved?
Well, I don't think it had anything to do with his contract. I mean, he signed that contract so long ago. It was after 2012 when he was MVP, after his MVP season. I mean, he was so young and early in his career, I don't think that there might have been anything in the contract itself. But I'm sure he probably made it known over the last few years that he would love to invest some of his fortune into the Giants. I mean, this is an organization, you know, that prints money. I mean, even if they're not selling out now. They're probably worth in the range of $4 billion. And, you know, ownership is where it's at. Buster doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who'd want to be a coach, who would be away from home, you know, all summer. I mean, he's got two school-age children. He has two toddlers now that he and his wife adopted last year or 2 years ago. He's moved back to Georgia. So, I mean, I think, you know, he wants to be involved and, you know, ownership is where it's at.
Do you think he's going to have a big say on what the Giants do maybe in the offseason, what they do during the season? Because you talk about the resource they have at their fingertips now and what a great move it is. I don't know about you, but it's made me feel a lot more comfortable about the direction of the organization. Not that Farhan's doing a bad job, but when you have a lot of analytic influence, it's always nice to have that baseball counter influence to bounce things off of. And if you were Buster Posey and you are an owner of the team, what's the first thing you do?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I think the first thing that he's doing right now is, I mean, he's on the board of directors and, you know, the board of directors is going to be deciding how much money Farhan and the club is going to have to spend this year. I think one thing he's already been doing, and I've read this from some of the writers who are actively working, is that he has already been counseling, I guess, Farhan Zaidi. On some of the players that the team has been looking at. And, you know, this is especially important in these first few years of Posey's retirement because he's played against pretty much all of the guys that they're talking about, all these potential free agents and whatnot. You know, one thing that I think you have to point out here is that, they have not said how much or what percentage of the team that he's bought. I don't imagine it's a huge, huge percentage. I don't think that he's anywhere close to what Charles Johnson has, for instance, or, the Burns daughters, Rob Dean and whatnot. I think he's going to be more asked to offer his opinion on the field in the beginning. But, you know, down the road, he's going to be, as a member of the board of directors, the entire direction of the organization, where they're going to go philosophically and whatnot. And, I mean, he's going to be at every board of directors meeting. And, you know, there's only, I think, six directors. So, you know, it's a pretty heady group. It includes, you know, Greg Johnson and Larry Bear and a couple of the other top owners. And so, you know, this is a pretty important deal for the organization.
Do you have to wear like a white wig and a robe and then you get sworn in? It's a secret ceremony to be part of this council?
You have to bend over and run through the gauntlet of paddles on your butt.
Thank you, sir. May I have another? And now you're officially the owner, one of the owners of the San Francisco Giants. So I saw your tweet and I kind of liked it. 19 hours ago, it says here on Twitter, Buster, we're going to sign Judge, Trey Turner, and Jacob deGrom. So we need to do a cash call. What do you think? Do you think there's anything like that that could happen this offseason for the Giants? Some scenario where they sign like three or four guys like that?
Before I answer that, the answer is going to be yes. I should point out that they don't have to do cash calls anymore. That was back in the candlestick days when they were losing so much money that the owners had to keep writing checks at the end of the year. Now they just print money. But yeah, I do. I absolutely do. And as one of my Twitter followers pointed out, instead of saying DeGrom, I should have just said re-signing Rodon, which would be a bigger deal in my opinion. I think common sense. But yeah, I mean, look, this is an organization that hired Farhan Zaidi to kind of replicate what the Dodgers did by building from the bottom up, building from the farm system up. And I think everybody acknowledges that the farm system has not produced as quickly as they would have hoped. I mean, this is now going to be the fifth year of the Zaidi regime. He's already had four drafts. Now, granted, they lost time with the season 2020 minor league season being eliminated, but other organizations have brought up some good prospects who were drafted in the last few years. I mean, you know, Michael Harris is a great example in Atlanta. And look, they won 107 games last year. They're probably going to have a losing record this year unless they have a 9-3 finish now. And this is an organization that really doesn't want to have two more years like that in a row. And it doesn't look like any of the big-time prospects who could really make a difference are going to have an impact in 2023, except perhaps for Kyle Harrison, the pitcher, who's just on a fast track. But you're talking offensively. And I think this is an organization that's a little embarrassed to have dropped so much in the win total. And you have to bring that total up any way you can. And I don't think that this whole notion of having a roster of 26 guys who just sort of mix and match and platoon, I think even the front office acknowledges that that really is not sustainable. So, yeah, they have been saving their pennies, and they had a kind of mid-level payroll this year. I think I read it was 13th in the majors. This is a team that has always had a top five, top six payroll, and I think they're going to go out and do their best to spend the money.
All right, Henry Schulman, nice enough to join the show tonight on KNBR 680, the sports leader. So, Henry, when you go out and chase free agents and you spend a lot of money on free agents, to me, that's a quick fix. And yeah, will we be excited about Giants baseball next year if they sign the guys you're talking about? Will we be excited about the 2023 season? Absolutely. We'll go nuts. They're going to catch the Dodgers. They sign this guy, this guy, this guy. But in my experiences in baseball, and you know this as well as anybody, you win over the long haul by having a tremendous farm system. That's right. How you stay great for a long time. And right now, some of the prospects haven't panned out. So how do you replenish your farm system? Because we could put a Band-Aid on this, and we could get super excited about next season, and there'll be butts in the seats, and they'll be competitive. But is this a recipe to be competitive for a long time?
Well, I think it is, because they have the ability to overspend. And let's face it, they're going to have to overpay to get some of these guys to come to San Francisco. Look, Aaron Judge, I don't think he's going to leave New York. I think the Yankees will do anything possible to keep a guy who's going to hit 60-something home runs and break the all-time American League record, who might be doing it while we're talking right now. And look, Rodon, they're a little hinky about spending that kind of money on pitching. But you have to overspend on these guys. And one of the ways you make up for that is not having to spend on your prospects. So they can afford to do it this way. And it's not like the Giants farm system is starting from scratch. This is not 2018 with the farm system. They have some very good prospects. Kyle Harrison is almost, if he stays healthy, is almost a no-lose, top-of-the-rotation type starter. Luciano is still a very young kid who, one scout, I asked the scout if he's going to have to move to third, and the scout said he's probably going to have to move to the outfield, but he's athletic enough to do it. He was held back this year by a sore back. When he came back, he just destroyed the Northwest League. Now he's at AA helping out Richmond in the playoffs. They have a third baseman named Casey Schmidt. Not too many people know about him. He was a second-round draft pick. Same scout I was talking to told me that this guy might be the best position player they have in the farm system, and he's had a quick rise. So it's not like they're starting from zero. They have some good prospects. And if you sign these free agents, some of these free agents to lengthy contracts, I think initially the idea is we don't want to do that because we don't want to clog up the roster and hold our guys back. But if the guys aren't coming up, you have to do something now. And I think if you have a mix of good free agents and prospects coming up, then I think it's sustainable, especially for an organization that can afford to take the financial hit down the road.
So you think they can compete with the Dodgers next year if they do all these things?
Well, yeah, I think they can. I mean, they competed with the Dodgers last year, and they didn't have anywhere near the kind of team that we're envisioning for next year. And, you know, a lot of people will say now that this was a fluke, but you can't win 106 games in a fluke. I mean, they had a system, and it panned out. I think the big difference between last year and this year was they did kind of mix and match at some positions last year, but they still had a pretty steady at certain positions. Catcher, for instance, shortstop. You had an MVP candidate, in Crawford. You had Buster Posey behind the plate. You know, Belt was hurt as usual, but he had a good year when he played. And there wasn't much platooning going on. This year they pretty much had the platoon everywhere. Every position was a mix and match. And I think that's the big difference. You go out and get some free agents who are quality free agents. It could be one of the shortstops who's out there. You sign one of them, then you figure out the whole situation with Crawford later because he's going to come back. And if you have some certain positions that are just set every day that Kapler can just write the name in, then you can do the whole mix and match thing. And the Giants have proven they're pretty good at that.
Yeah, I think the mix and match thing and the platoon thing works when it's only two or three or four guys in your lineup, exactly, and you have a bunch of guys that are everyday guys. But when you're doing that with seven or eight guys in your lineup, that's not conducive in my mind, and I've seen it not work this year, to keeping anybody fresh. The whole thing was, well, we're keeping them all fresh. It's hard to put together a streak as a hitter or to stay locked in as a hitter when all of a sudden three lefties come along and I'm sitting for 3 days and then I got to play again. And so, yeah, I'm with you. Have like four or five guys that are everyday guys, mix and match the other four guys, and we'll see what happens. Talking to Henry Schulman on KNBR tonight, nice enough to join us tonight. You talked about Aaron Judge. I don't think there's a way that he comes to San Francisco. I don't think there's a way the Yankees let him go, I guess is a better way to put it. I don't think he doesn't want to come here. I think there's no way they can let him go. And you talk about the home run chase and how historic this season is offensively for him. We're keeping an eye on it. We're watching it. And it takes us all back to Barry Bonds. This is where I go with it. We've seen a home run chase in these parts. We've seen big home runs. We've seen people diving for baseballs in the masses in the bleachers and trying to come up with some value in a baseball. So all of this has taken me back to 2001, the 756, when he hit 73 home runs in 2001, then the 756 later. I mean, talk about, there's a lot of people out there right now, Henry, saying if Aaron Judge hits 62, he's the forever home run champ, and what Barry Bonds did doesn't count. I want to get your opinion on this and maybe some memories from you covering the home run chase with Barry Bonds.
The ulcer days. Okay. Look, the number is the number. And what I wrote, my lead when the first paragraph of my story, when he hit 756, I said I kind of paraphrased the call of Henry Aaron, 750 or 715th, whatever it was. And I said, there's a new home run champion of all times, and it's Barry Bonds, but everybody has to decide in their own hearts whether he is the all-time home run king. And I think that's true. I mean, the number is the number. And I saw an interesting debate. I guess Buster Olney from ESPN called Judge saying that this is the greatest, offensive season of all time. I like Buster. I believe in him. He's very smart and very intelligent. But, when you look at Bonds and how few pitches he actually saw, I just saw today where Alex Cora said in the Red Sox-Yankees series, he's not going to pitch around Judge. He's going to go after him. Nobody went after Bonds in 2000. I mean, he walked 242 times. They're not doing that with Aaron Judge. So I do believe that Bonds put together some of the best years offensively in history. And I don't think Judge is up there. And if people want to say he is because he's, clean or suspected to be clean, I mean, I think that's their right. My memories of this were, it wasn't a happy time for me because I'm kind of a guy who really, some guys just live for the big, huge story. And I kind of live to cover a team. And it was hard to cover a team, when Bonds was at the center of everything. In 2001, the Giants were in it until the third to last night of the season when he actually hit the two home runs that set the record against the Dodgers, and people really didn't care all that much, and not too much about it. They weren't, you know, too overly forlorn that they didn't make the playoffs. And then, you know, when he was going for the all-time record in 2007, it was just really impossible to cover the team. The team wasn't that good. Media from all over the country came, and, you know, I just felt stuck in something I really didn't care all that much about compared to the team itself. And I do want to point one thing out about this relates to Judge, and if he hits 60-something home runs this year. I remember the winter meetings after the 2006 season when Bonds was clearly close to breaking the all-time record, and his contract had just run out, that five-year contract he signed after he set the single-season record. And I was at the winter meetings, and the Giants absolutely panicked when Bonds flew to the winter meetings supposedly to have a meeting with the Detroit Tigers, where Jim Leland, his old manager, was managing. And I mean, I got on the plane, and before I landed back home, they had already signed Bonds to an $18 million contract. And I don't know if the Yankees will panic if they can't sign Judge right away, but I think they're going to do everything in their financial power, even at the risk of having to pay more in luxury tax to keep him.
Wow, that's great stuff. I never thought about that as a writer on the beat, that you're assigned to cover a team and not one guy, and that all of a sudden your focus had to be on one person and every move they made and not about the team and not about the games. And even if you did write a great game piece, no one cared, right? It was just all about Barry Bonds.
And not only that, I mean, you'd have 50, 60 reporters in the clubhouse. So all the players you needed to talk to about what was going on, they all hid in the back room, you know, where the writers aren't allowed, the food room and whatever, weight room. They all hid back there because they knew that if they stepped one foot in the clubhouse, they'd have 50, 60 reporters coming up to them and asking them about the Bonds chase and asking them about steroids. And they didn't want anything to do it. And actually, I loved covering Giants games at home because sort of toward the end there in 2007 and to some degree at the end of 2001, I loved it because the Chronicle would send out a columnist or a separate reporter to just cover the Bonds thing. And that freed me up to write about the team. And I mean, I had to write a lot about Bonds. I mean, you go back to my clips. I mean, I wrote hundreds and hundreds of stories about Bonds and the home run chase, but it just wasn't my happiest writing. My happiest writing was when I got to write a really good feature story about a player who maybe nobody knew anything about. And all of a sudden he was making a name for himself in the major leagues. And I just ran across, I was cleaning some stuff out today. I ran across the 2003 feature I wrote about Felipe Alou when they hired him. And I went to Florida and, you know, I wrote about 3,000 words. That's the kind of stuff I like to do.
Or when some punk kid from the Expos comes up to you in the clubhouse and says, hey, get off our relievers. They're not that bad. And you ripped him in the paper yesterday. Leave him alone. I forget what our conversation was when we met.
You know what? That was relatively early in my career when I really was scared to death when a player got on my ass. I mean, that was, you know, if you had done that in 2005, I would have said, and you are?
Which is what you should have said the first time, because I had a whole 3 years in with the Expos, and, you know, when you're the veteran at that point because everybody was leaving for greener pastures. And so I felt the need when I heard a couple of relievers rumbling about they were going through the newspaper. Remember when you had newspapers? They were going through the newspaper in the clubhouse, and there was an article by this guy named Henry Shulman, the Chronicle, saying something about, I forget what you said exactly, but it got on the relievers, and I felt the need to defend them. Or maybe it was even the headline or something.
It was the headline.
Yeah, the Expos relievers suck, I think, was the headline. And I said, hey.
Like that.
I said, Henry, Mr. Shulman. No, I didn't say Mr. Shulman. I said, Henry, what is this? And I grabbed the paper and showed it to you, and that's how we first met. And we've been friends for, I don't know, 20-something years since then.
25 years. And I mean, the funny thing is that you did something that probably no other writer would do, was you explained to me, you didn't know me from Adam, and you explained to me that the reason that the relievers sucked was you had a rotation of guys who couldn't go more than three innings. So, of course, I mean, they're overworked and all that. You trusted me to say that. I mean, I didn't print that or anything like that. It was the headline. Honestly, one of the reasons I lasted for 33 years and was able to do, I think, a creditable job was that I made it a point fairly early in my career never to write anything personal or nasty about a player. I went into the clubhouse every day thinking that everybody in here can do something I could never do. So, yes, my job is to write about when they're not doing it well. That's my responsibility. I have responsibility to the paper, the readers, you know, to say, hey, this guy is terrible right now. But I never use the kind of language that, you know, some of the columnists would use to just say a guy was awful or this guy isn't a major league hitter or things of that nature. And I think the players, to some degree, respected that.
Absolutely. And you're intelligent enough to be creative enough to find a way to word it that it's not going to be a dagger and insult somebody. And I did the same thing as a broadcaster, and I try to do the same thing as a radio show host, where you could get your point across in sort of an intelligent way that's not demeaning or personal and attacking somebody. And, you know, I had to go in the clubhouse every day as a broadcaster and look these guys in the eye on the plane, on the bus. So you found a way to be critical without being ultra critical where it's going to piss somebody off. And I think that's an art. I think the other way's lazy, Henry. I might be wrong, but I think the other way is just lazy and you're going for clicks.
Yeah. Even before there were clicks, I mean, and you're going for people to pick up the paper. I mean, you know, there were times I still pissed people off. I mean, I still, you know, there were some players who, you know, didn't like what I wrote or the way I wrote something. And, some of my mentors early on, guys like Kit Steer at the Oakland Tribune, Nick Peters and all that. One of the things they told me was, if you ever wrote anything critical about anybody, make sure yours is the first face they see in the clubhouse the next day. And so you let them kind of come, you know, yell at you a little bit, and you let them kind of get it off their chest. And then if they're open minded about it, you explain, OK, here's why I wrote this. And here's why I wrote it this way. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, maybe 19 times out of 20, I walked away and the player probably still didn't like what I wrote, but he had a little bit more of an understanding of why I wrote it, and it didn't ruin the relationship.
Oh, good stuff from Hemi Schulman. Hemi, we got to run. We're up against the clock. Can't thank you enough for coming on. I mean, just taking me back to the days when we met, you in the clubhouse, you as a beat writer. I don't know. It's like a time machine when I come on the show every night, reuniting with all my old friends. And I can't thank you enough for coming on, man.
You got it, man. The worst part about the whole thing was I had to actually walk into that stinky visitor's clubhouse at Candlestick to talk to you.
That was bad. Not much better than the home side, but these guys
better, but it was, yeah.
All right, Henry, thanks for your time, man. Have a great weekend. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.